Greetings. I'm Malcolm Brown, director of the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative, and welcome to this ELI 7 Things podcast. In this podcast, we are marking the 100th issue of the ELI 7 Things You Should Know About publication. My guests today are Diana Oblinger, president of EDUCAUSE, and Cyprian Lomas, assistant dean of learning technologies and director of the LFS Learning Center at the University of British Columbia. Diana and Cyprian were the originators of the 7 Things, launching it in April 2005 with an issue on clickers. Diana and Cyprian, welcome to the ELI podcast.
Thanks for having us, Malcolm.
Thanks, Malcolm.
So, when you reach the century mark in almost anything, it's time to take stock and reflect on where things have come from. So, perhaps we could begin by you telling us about the origin of the 7 Things publication. What was the rationale, and what were you looking to accomplish?
It's kind of funny that it started out with a conversation and just an idea and a phrase that Cyprian, I think it was Ruben Poynteneris, that said, well, there's 7 things you should know about this. And you and I had another conversation and said, that was really catchy. What could we do with 7 things? And the idea quickly became, how can you communicate a new technology to non-technical people in a simple, concise, non-threatening way so that they would develop the confidence that they knew enough to begin having a conversation. And, of course, the reason for doing that was not just to teach people about technology, but to accelerate the adoption of IT. And you have to start that by getting people engaged. And if they can't talk about it, then they aren't likely to know about it, and they're less likely to implement it. So that's sort of the evolution as I remember it.
And one additional person, Nick Noakes, was definitely one of the people that spoke about the 7 things, and the idea is that that's roughly the number of things that number of items that a person can remember quite readily. So it's also pretty catchy. And I think the other goal was that as we were looking at emerging technologies at the time, and things like podcasts, which seem really commonplace now, were emerging at the time, and there seemed to be a lot of hype around emerging technologies and people scrambling to try and figure out what to do about them. And so by being able to talk about any emerging technology in a measured and common sense way, to talk about both the pros and the cons, seemed like a wonderful tool to help educate and sort of frame any conversation about anything new, I think.
And it was a great way for us to learn about it, too. I mean, every time we did one of these, we had to learn something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the education piece is probably just as important as the articles in some ways.
Well, you know, the 7 things, you must have hit something right, because the 7 things publication has really become a staple of the literature in teaching and learning, as it is read by folks not only from higher education, but also in the K-12 sector. Why do you think it's developed such a wide readership?
I think that it meets a need. People want to know in a concise way what all this stuff is about. So there's an interest out there. It's simple. It respects the fact that for almost everyone, time is at a premium. So it makes subjects that might sound confusing or complicated accessible to people. And you may not be able to read a 25-page paper, but most people can skim something that is 2 pages and calls out some high points. So I think the simplicity of it may be one of the reasons it's been very popular.
I completely agree there. I think that the fact that it's a quick read, and I think we had stated it might even be a 2-minute read, so it's something that you can give to somebody and even sit there and watch them while they read it. And the other point that's particularly enjoyable about them is that I think that they reference the community as well. And so in every case, the 7 Things tries to look for examples that are happening already in the community. That can be both inspiring, and it can also just give any practitioner or potential practitioner a sense of what the potential is.
So back in 2005, when you first launched the series, the first issues covered topics that, it's interesting that we today take for granted, such as clickers, social bookmarking, podcasting, wikis, and blogs. But what was your guiding principle in terms of selecting the topics?
I think it was to find something new. Cyprian and I both did a lot of self-education through these, so we'd go to conferences or talk to colleagues, and when you'd hear something you didn't really know about, we'd many times consider that as something that we would make into a Seven Things. And as you noted earlier, one of the early ones was around podcasting, and truly, when ELI did its first podcasting, nobody knew what it was. It's hard to imagine these days, but if you think about how many new technologies there are and how many new pedagogical approaches, we may never run out of things that are new to talk about.
One of the places that we often looked for new things is also just communities of practice. Very often you will find a small group of people who are doing something really quite special, but they're completely oblivious that what they're doing is special. And it often takes an outsider's eye to sort of distill what it is they're doing and then to make that community aware of how special it actually is.
So the publication has pretty much followed the same template for its full 8 years, the seven questions that form its template or its skeleton, so to speak. Was it difficult to arrive at those seven particular questions? And what was your angle on including a scenario with each issue?
I think we came up with those seven items by just talking about what are the things you would want to know, starting with the most obvious question, which is, what is it? And then kind of moving along from there. And of course, we could have had, and I think in the early versions, we maybe did have more than seven, but we tried to keep it narrowed down to the things that were most important for people to know about. And the scenario came about because for many people, you can describe what something is, but if they can't picture it in their mind, they don't remember it and they don't understand it. So the scenario was all about painting a picture so people could imagine the technology being used in real life. And as Cyprian noted, one of the things that was really helpful is looking at how people were already putting some of those technologies into practice. So it did reflect sometimes what was going on in the community.
And my take about the seven questions is they almost seem to just be obvious and flow. I mean, I don't recall a lot of deliberation about which questions to include. They just really seem to be sort of common sense types of questions that you should ask about any new practice or technology.
So the title of this issue number 100 is Seven Ways to Use Seven Things. So let me ask you, what are ways that you've used Seven Things?
Well, typically I find that they're fantastic communication pieces. So if I come across somebody that is interested in a topic that really may be at a stage of it being a buzzword, I find that I can pass along the Seven Things, which is typically already covered, mapped out the buzzword, pass it along to a person and have them be able to make some informed decisions about them. The piece that I see at times from my vantage point is that there are times when a buzzword gets introduced into a conversation and it's almost used as a weapon in some ways, where the people that know about it are able to throw it around and the people that don't know about it are sort of feeling that they are not equal partners in the conversation. So I sort of see the seven things as a great equalizer. And this is at all levels. I send it to friends who aren't in education. I send it to my administrators, send it to colleagues as well.
And I've used it with presidents, provost, trustees, because they have a low tolerance for, as Cyprian mentioned, people using words against them, like, well, you don't know what this means, but it must be a really big deal. And so it helps demystify a lot of things, and I've found it to be very effective there. I've also come to understand that there's a lot of use of the seven things among K-12 and teachers, for example, so that they understand some of the technologies that are out there. So as Cyprian said, I don't think it's just about it being useful in the academic community. People who just want to know can pick those up and understand pretty quickly what we're talking about.
Okay. Do you have a favorite story in which a community member has used Seven Things, or do you have a favorite recollection about how a particular issue came into being?
One thing that I've observed is that a number of schools, including the University of British Columbia and Penn State, seem to have embraced the Seven Things so much that they've spun off their own copycats of it, where they're covering different topics. And in particular, I think Penn State also had another approach where they put together a small team that would research a topic of interest. I think they called these hot teams. And again, I think that the practice of exploring a new technology and trying to figure out what makes it tick and the potential and the shortcomings of it really is a pretty useful activity.
I have sort of a dated story that I always enjoyed, and that is one of our ELI members used to have a display out front of the Learning Technology Center with printed copies of the Seven Things. Of course, that sounds very dated now, but people would pick them up on the way in, on the way out, as they were going down the hall. It became something you would pick up and read as you went along to stay engaged. The other way that I think I've seen them used, interestingly, is to pick up the scenarios and string the scenarios together as a way of helping people imagine what the future of learning might be like from, most often, a student's perspective. So rather than just talking about the technology, which is the tool, really stringing together the scenarios and helping people understand what it would be like from the learner's side to be learning in those very different ways that the technologies enable.
Well, the ELI has been publishing, as I said, the Seven Things for just a bit over 8 years now. And over that time, we've seen lots of technology parade past. We've seen major upheavals in higher education, teaching, and learning, especially over the past 2 years. So I'm going to see if I can tempt you in doing a bit of prognostication. Where do you see things going over the next 1 or 2 years? Diana, do you want to start?
Oh, I was going to let Cyprian on this one first and see what he said. So my prognostication, which, Malcolm, you actually hit nicely in your upcoming EDUCAUSE review article, is around how all of these things become connected and become more of a whole. And I guess my vision of the future is similar to the world that we found ourselves in with mobile devices and apps, where you string all those things together and they are personalized, but they allow you to move in and out of the physical and the virtual for any kind of activity that you want to do. And because everyone and everything is now connected, you can imagine that creating a learning environment or a living environment that is very different. And of course, since it's online, part of the power is in the analytics, the kind of information that you can collect to understand how people learn differently and help them find pathways that will make them more successful. The final thing I would say about where I wonder if some of these things might be going is really challenging some of our fundamental assumptions about how we structure education, because a lot of these applications that have been written about and highlighted through the Seven Things series are almost outside of the educational system in a way in that they were created from the world at large rather than within a constrained system that's predicated on credit hours and semester terms and the like. And I think what may be coming next is that we really start to go past a lot of the historic assumptions that we've had. So a metaphor might be thinking about the classroom and how that's bounded by four walls and a physical presence. And of course, we talk about learning spaces and living simultaneously in multiple dimensions. And hopefully the future for us is going to be getting to that larger level of connectedness that goes beyond physical facilities, physical assets, and really connects us to this larger world of expertise and wonderful experiences.
I really liked everything that Diana said there. Some of the things that I also echoed or had in common with Diana were, I think that really we're, a lot of the things that we're seeing in the consumer space are that are just becoming accessible to everyday people may start to form the parts of this ecosystem. And so some of the things that I'm very interested in are sensors, self-monitoring, and when we think about analytics and knowing about your learning pathway, I think self-monitoring may be a way for students to take a lot more responsibility and ownership of their education. The other piece that seems to be out there a fair bit is, again, big data and tons of it, and what on earth do we do about it? There are visualization. I think we've got many, many years of sort of visualization technologies coming in. But perhaps also interesting are ambient displays of information, so things that might be just influencing your environment that you're not exactly thinking about real time, but they are affecting your mood and your affect or emotions that also contribute to teaching and learning or your learning. The other piece that I liked and think is also of huge potential is more sampling of our environments. We speak about classrooms as the four walls, but I think increasingly, at least in the spaces that I'm in, we're seeing outdoor classrooms or sampling the environment or sensors that can detect information about the environment and also where you are and proximity to others. I think that we may see more location-based stories and sort of augmented reality type applications as well. How this fits into the university, though, again, is a very tricky piece, but perhaps it helps individuals weave together a more personalized learning experience that they own more completely and that is more in line with their goals and values.
And there are all kinds of cool things out there, like Cyprian said, and I love the notion of moving outside and learning wherever you are in ecological settings and all kinds of things. But there are things that are in development like animated pedagogical agents that are lifelike characters. I mean, how cool would that be? There's just going to be all kinds of things. So, Malcolm, I think you're going to have a lot more seven things that you have to write about.
Well, we're very much looking forward to writing 100 more. And Diana and Cyprian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Malcolm. Thanks, Diana.
You're welcome. It's been a lot of fun.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Please don't forget to check out the ELI's 7 Things You Should Know About September issue, which is our 100th issue. It's available to anyone for downloading from the ELI website. A URL shortcut is bit.ly.com/7ThingsELI. That's the number 7 Things ELI. Thank you.